Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. As you may have noticed, we moved the podcast back. We usually tape this on Friday morning, but when the word went out that President Biden was going to take his third crack at addressing the country about the crisis in Afghanistan, we decided we were going to move it later in the afternoon on Friday so that Bill Kristol and I would have a chance to actually listen to the president. And whether or not the president changed his tone in any way, we are taping this, the president just wrapped up and made the commitment that any American who wants to come home is going to get home. Let's listen to a little bit of President Biden.
But let me be clear. Any American who wants to come home, we will get you home. But make no mistake, this evacuation mission is dangerous. It involves risks to our armed forces, and it's being conducted under difficult circumstances. I cannot promise what the final outcome will be, or what it will be, that it will be without risk of loss. But as Commander in Chief, I can assure you that I will mobilize every resource necessary. And as an American, I offer my gratitude to the brave men and women of the U.S. Armed Forces who are carrying out this mission. They're incredible.
And there were moments of empathy that some critics felt that they did not hear in the last two remarks that he made, where he talked about how gut-wrenching the scenes were. But then he also said that there would be plenty of time to criticize, but right now it was all about the mission.
As is the case, whenever I deploy our troops into harm's way, I take that responsibility seriously. I carry that burden every day. Just as I did when I was vice president, my son was deployed to Iraq for a year. There'll be plenty of time to criticize and second guess when this operation is over. But now, I'm focused on getting this job done. I would ask every American to join me in praying for the women and men risking their lives on the ground in the service of our nation.
So joining me to look back at this week and this speech, who better than our colleague Bill Kristol? Bill, you've been listening to the president this afternoon?
I watched him this afternoon, right? And now we're speaking just after he took a few questions and left the stage there at the White House.
So I would say, and feel free to disagree with me as you always do, that the first two attempts to address the fiasco, the debacle in Afghanistan were less than optimal. In fact, I think that they were kind of distressing. Let me put it that way. That feels like a euphemism. Did the president change his tone? Did he say anything that you were really hoping that he would say? Did he leave certain things still unsaid? Give me your take of where we're at right now.
I'm happy to, and I agree with you. I was very distressed by his previous speeches. I'm most distressed, of course, by what's happening on the ground. And there, so for the speeches to really cheer me up, they'd have to announce a greater recognition of what's gone wrong and some changes in planning and policy to try to make things better or to rethink things. I didn't see much or really any of that. I've got to say, a little edging forward in terms of we are going to do whatever it takes to get the Americans out. That might indicate that 2 weeks from now, if the Taliban isn't being as cooperative as the president seems to portray them as being for now, he'll do a few more things, but no fundamental sense that, you know, this isn't going well, that we're not on course to get most of our Afghan friends out, and that the whole thing has been so, well, that it just isn't going well and hasn't gone well. You know, I'm very struck, you played that, the second clip you played, it hadn't really occurred to me when I was watching it live, but the president said, I just scribbled this down, I think this is right, whenever I deploy American troops into harm's way, I take that responsibility seriously. And he mentioned his son who served in Iraq. Think of that, step back, which is a very normal thing to say and a perfectly appropriate thing to say, but think about it for a minute. Whenever I deploy American troops into harm's way, he's correct. He has now deployed, what, 5,000, 6,000, right, American troops into harm's way to get American citizens out of Kabul, a city that, out of a country that we've been in for 20 years, that we've, you know, had some problems in, obviously, but that I was going to say we've controlled, but that we, you know, we and a friendly government basically controlled for almost all that time, in the capital city of which we had a massive presence. What does it say that you have to deploy troops into harm's way to finish an evacuation that you had months to plan for, that you have, that everyone, that he'd announced, that everyone knew was coming, plenty of time to negotiate with the Taliban if that's what you wanted to do. Again, that's a, for me, that just put the exclamation point, hearing that once again, of what a fiasco this is, that we're evacuating troops. And to do so, we're deploying 6,000 troops into what the president himself describes as an extremely challenging and chaotic situation.
I don't think that it is a but Trump moment to point out that this really is a bipartisan screw-up of epic proportions, that in many ways this really is the Trump-Biden fiasco with Donald Trump and Mike Pompeo essentially surrendering to the Taliban and shutting down for months at a time any of the interviews of the Afghan translators and other people who were wanting those special visas. But as you tweeted out just a few minutes ago, you know, some of the Biden supporters who have been critical of Trump's 2020 agreement do so as a way of excusing Biden, but you heard Biden basically saying that the deal was in fact consistent with what he wanted to do. So let's talk about that for a moment. I heard him say that that had he not pulled out, given what the situation that Trump had left him with, that he would have had to have surged a massive number of troops. But it's obvious that he wanted out as badly as possible. And as you pointed out earlier, and he got it, he pulled out as badly as possible.
Yeah, I mean, didn't he say, I think he said earlier this week that, you know, he would have gotten out, he was campaigning to get out of Afghanistan before the Trump-Pompeo agreement in early 2020. And I think that's true, and that's been his position, and that's fine. But then you can't really get too upset as a Biden supporter about the Trump-Pompeo agreement. Maybe it made the withdrawal a little harder. If there hadn't been that agreement, there would have been a Biden-Blinken agreement in March of 2021, I suppose, with the Taliban, and maybe that would have all gone more smoothly. But Biden made him, I think correctly in a way, said today, made it seem as if he's simply carrying out the obvious implications of what Trump did, that he agrees with the thrust of what Trump did. And he certainly was not only reluctant, but refused to do anything to really change the emphasis of the direction that we were going based on what Trump did. He did finally speed up a little bit the visa programs and stuff, though even that he was extremely slow to recognize how incredibly far behind we were, or he must have recognized, it was widely reported, incredibly slow to act on that. There was very little urgency, and members of Congress of both parties, who many of whom had served in Afghanistan, wrote pretty frantic letters when you look at them back in the spring of this year. I mean, not the normal letter you write if you're a member of Congress, especially to a president of your own party, saying, what is going on, you know? So,
well, there was one factual comment that's getting a lot of attention, at least. And I want to, pull the lens back in just a moment. But, sticking with the president's remarks, the president said that he had no intelligence that Americans had not been able to get to the Kabul airport. And so the question was, does that square with what we're seeing on the ground? And all the reporters are kind of lining up going, no, I mean, totally not. A lot of Americans are having a very, very tough time running that Taliban gauntlet. So it is simply not true. And I was sort of hoping for a much more definitive statement that, we will come and get you, and that Americans would do what the French and the Germans and others have been doing, which is to actually send people outside the perimeter and getting their nationals in. But that was an unfortunate moment, because clearly what you have is, you have pictures, you have images of Americans who are not able to get to the airport, and the president saying, I don't know anything about that.
Didn't you think, Charlie, that he sort of retreated then to what he meant to be saying was, well, his Americans, once they prove they're Americans, and that sometimes takes a while, especially if they might have be dual nationality or have an Afghan spouse or something, or of Afghan descent or Middle Eastern descent. Nonetheless, eventually the Taliban apparently let them through those checkpoints. Okay, I don't know if that's entirely true, but let's stipulate that that's true. But then when they get to the mob scene around the airport, they don't all make it through, and it's very dangerous. And we know what there was an interview, very good interview this morning on ABC, of an American who has been in Afghan, a tough, seemed like a big guy, tough guy, not some kind of a healthy youngish guy, who had thought this through and finally taken his wife and daughter, and I think another a couple as well with their child, and gone to the airport. They couldn't make it through the crush outside. Now, that somehow Biden is distinguishing, I guess, from the Taliban checkpoints. That's just the chaos around the airport.
Yeah.
Well, we have 6,000 troops there. I mean, he didn't really get pushed on this question of why not expand the perimeter. And that's complicated. I'm not, you know.
We'd have to send more troops. I mean.
Yeah, you might have to send more troops. I'm not sure you would. 6,000 is a lot of troops. I mean, I talked to someone who served in Afghanistan last night who said, I mean, it's a pretty chaotic situation, but you don't really need 6,000. If you're securing one airstrip and processing people inside the airport, it's not clear that you need 6,000 troops for that. Now, if you have a chaotic situation outside and you're trying to manage that, you are. But the way you make a situation less chaotic outside is you then go outside and establish order. Now, he doesn't want to do that. That probably would require, as a matter of prudence, more troops. And then, of course, you could say, well, the perimeter outside that will be chaotic. Yeah, so it's none of this is easy or a solution. But I thought it was revealing, as you suggested, the fact that he's thinking of it in as narrow a way as possible. So if literally no American has been ultimately turned away at an actual Taliban manned checkpoint, then there's kind of not a problem. The agreement's working fine, as if that's the only thing but if the Taliban's going house to house searching for the interpreters, if mobs that are Taliban friendly are outside the airport, or mobs of people trying to get into the airport are more, maybe this is more the case, are making it very hard to get there, and the Taliban isn't policing that. Maybe we don't want them to police that, but then we have to police it. And so, again, it's a certain kind of evasion of fundamental responsibility for the situation, I think.
Yeah, here's the take from our good friend Eli Stokols from the Los Angeles Times. He said, in broad strokes, Biden's not giving an inch on his Afghan decision execution, but at least the tone seemed like a do-over. He took questions, was less prickly than in the ABC interview, less defiant. He expressed more empathy for desperate Afghans and sought to present the latest numbers as progress. But the new tone doesn't obscure the obvious discrepancy here. Biden claiming that he's going to keep his promise to the Afghan allies and acknowledging the Taliban is only allowing U.S. passport holders into the airport. So there is clearly a little bit of tension there. But also, just looking at the situation that we're in right now, I mean, the Taliban control the country. And right now, there's obviously some sort of an agreement, tacit and explicit, that they're going to behave themselves to a certain extent. Are Biden's options constrained by the fact that if he's too forceful or if he's too negative, that the Taliban will say, well, screw you. We're going to start killing Americans. We'll take hostages and you'll be back in an Iran hostage situation. I mean, right now, I mean, in a sense, you know, he's got to work with the Taliban. And isn't that kind of, again, one of the, oh, my God, how did we get to this point?
Yeah, well, it is a how bad we get to this point. No, but I agree with that. And I've not been one of those. And I've sort of tried to privately even caution some friends of ours, you know, to be screaming and yelling about that he's not, you know, denouncing the Taliban every 10 minutes. I mean, that would be, might be counterproductive. And they may be pulling their rhetorical punches in certain ways to make sure that this agreement that they think is working adequately for now to at least get people through the checkpoints, that continues. Of course, the Taliban doesn't control things that much. I mean, like any insurgent force taking over, you know, a city, they've got all kinds of elements and, you know, God knows what could be happening. It doesn't look like, I talked to someone last night who's in touch with trying to get some people out and therefore is in touch with and has been in government. So he's in touch with actual people there, both inside and outside the airport. He's worried that the situation is not getting better. It's getting worse. That is to say, there's not more Taliban control. Let's call it the, mainstream Taliban or whatever, governing Taliban control. There might be less. And then we read this morning, don't we, that the Haqqani network, Haqqani himself is back in Kabul. Mm-hmm. And the Haqqani network is in key places. That is a brutal terrorist and terrorist-affiliated organization and an al-Qaeda affiliate, incidentally. Longtime partner with al-Qaeda and terrorist efforts. Which that was one of the more stunning things in the press conference when Biden simply seemed to assert in passing that al-Qaeda is out of Afghanistan. I mean, no one believes that. Maybe they're not.
We have a picture of him right there.
Yeah. I mean, Haqqani's not quite al-Qaeda. You could, I guess, logic chop this one too. But anyway, I mean, so the whole thing, I mean, is depressing. On that point, certainly, another thing that didn't get enough attention is that if Biden is also inconsistent with what he was just saying, Biden's consistently talked about the over-the-horizon ability to do counterterrorism. You don't have to have troops on the ground. Turns out that he asked Putin at the summit to facilitate bases in the one or more of the stands down there, whichever one it was, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, I don't know. I don't know that we know. But they would, Putin probably would have a veto over that, given Russia's dominant influence there. And Putin said, no, well, if we're not worried about the over-the-horizon present, you know, if it's so easy to do counterterrorism from far away, why are we desperately asking Putin, to let us station troops there? It makes you think that maybe it would have been prudent not to pull everyone out and keep, you know, a few thousand troops at Bagram and a few thousand troops in Kabul, and even if a lot of the rest of the country, frankly, went bad, have those bases for counterterrorism, or make an arrangement before we got out. That's the thing that I keep coming back to, and I've talked to so many people, as you have, the last few days, who've been, you know, in these kinds of difficult policy situations before, to simply say get out, and then, you know, we don't care in a sense about the consequences. We're not going to do the many other things we have to do at the same time, which might slow down the withdrawal or change the way we do it or make us think about other things that are very important. There seems to have been none of that. He ordered the military to get out, and we don't want American casualties. The military said, well, sir, we know how to do that. Safer is faster. Faster is safer. And, we'll just leave Bagram. If you leave Bagram in the middle of the night and fly off, you're not going to have any U.S. casualties. And that's a good thing, not to have U.S. casualties. You're also going to totally demoralize the Afghan army. You're going to leave the place to get trashed. You're not going to have a modern, fully capable airport from which to do the evacuation. You're not going to have done the evacuation yet. But to be fair to the military, no one asked them to weigh those things into consideration. I hope the Secretary of Defense at least said to the president, well, what about these other things? Certainly the National Security Advisor, his job is to say, well, wait a second, the only criterion here can't be faster is safer. We have other, it's not maybe safer for the Afghans who were committed to taking out, or the civilians in Kabul, or the spillover effects, you know, in the country and outside. But they seem to have had an incredibly, the degree to which the decision making therefore was so simple-minded in a way, or one track, I guess, is the, maybe one could say. And the one track was, we want to get the U.S. military out of there as quickly as possible. Not even the U.S. military plus U.S. civilians. Think about that for a minute. You're the president of the United States. You're supposed to keep 10 things in mind, our allies, the long term. But even leaving all that aside, it wasn't even get the U.S. civilians and the U.S. military, or the U.S. civilians and the Afghan, you know, helpers and friends and the U.S. military out safely. It was really seems to have been just, I want those troops out of there as soon and as safely as possible.
The part that I find the hardest to understand, though, and I understand that, I can imagine that conversation taking place, but clearly he was then relying on the Afghan military to, you know, hold the fort, right? That they would cover the retreat and that things would not fall apart. And yet they also, and you correct me again if I'm wrong, they also pulled all of the logistical support for the Afghan security forces. This is an army that had been trained to fight the way we fight, which is relying on air support, which requires people who will, you know, do the maintenance, who have manage the supply chains. And as far as I can see, we also pulled the plug on all of that, so made it very, very difficult for the Afghan security forces to fight. They didn't have the air cover. They didn't have the logistical support. They didn't have the supply lines that they would have had. You would have thought that there would have been a conversation saying, okay, Mr. President, we'll get all the troops out, but what we have to do is we have to make sure that our support, our logistical support for the Afghan military stays intact, at least for a while. But apparently that didn't happen either.
Well, you're totally right, but that support was mostly contractors. But you still would have to have some troops to protect the contractors. And there you get back to the fact that either no one was willing to tell President Biden, hey, look, we need to keep some troops. We cannot just draw down as quickly as possible to where were we below 1,000 when the fiasco began a week ago? And now we're built back up to 6,000, 7,000. We're going to have to stay at 2,500, manage these different parts, get different types of people out in sort of stages, see what happens as we do so, see how fast we think things are going to fall apart. If we think they're falling apart fast, we might have to have a very temporary surge back in to stabilize till we get people out. I mean, that would be the normal decision-making process. I'm not inventing some fanciful, complicated thing. This would be a normal way if someone said, the President of the United States said, I ultimately want us out of there, and I want us out of there reasonably soon. What I've just been saying would be the absolutely normal conversation between the Secretary of State and the National Security Advisor and the Secretary of Defense and so forth. It just doesn't seem to have happened in any serious way at all.
So as you saw, the former president issued a statement yesterday saying what he would have done. First of all, you bring out all the American citizens, then you bring out all the equipment, then you bomb the bases into smithereens, and then you bring out the military. You don't do it in reverse order like Biden and our woke generals did. No chaos, no death. They wouldn't even know we left. So any confidence that Trump would have done this better?
Well, I mean, he doesn't mention the Afghans at all, so he just would have left the Afghans. I think that's probably consistent with his general view of these things.
Well, he did propose a complete and total ban on Muslims, and we know that Stephen Miller has been one of the most adamant opponents of having the special immigrant visas for Afghans. So that's a fair assumption.
Fox News, right, is now against letting in people who have spent their whole lives fighting militant Islamist terrorists. So it's like, I don't know, aren't we like those kinds of people? I mean, even if you're dubious about other refugee programs and stuff. But I mean, Trump, maybe he would have done, I mean, who knows? He was incapable of managing a serious process too. And incidentally, if he'd still been president, it would have been his second term, and God knows who would have been in charge of the Defense Department and other key agencies. So that's another problem. It would have, in Biden's case, I think we have competent people at the top of these agencies at least. So I have no great confidence in Trump. I will say this, honestly, though, that the actual two sentences or so that you read is a more logical way to pull people out, It's kind of get everyone you want to get out first, and then get the soldiers out. That is kind of an obvious, if you're really into the getting out business, it's kind of how you get out of things, right? And I mean, the fact that Trump makes a certain amount of sense, very limited amount of sense here, is maybe, for people like me, the ultimate, what's ultimately the most damning thing about this, that you read a Trump tweet and you think, there's some truth to that.
So let's pull back the lens a little bit. New polls out suggesting that the majority of Americans do not think that the war was worth fighting at all. I think more than 60%. So we can separate out the two questions of, was it a right to withdraw versus the way that we are withdrawing. But let me ask you that more fundamental question. Was this, looking back for the full 20 years, was this war worth fighting if we're leaving it this way?
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, on the polls, I would just make the obvious point that, when two presidents in a row, and in some ways, President Obama, more complicated in his second term at least, kind of are so critical of a war, you can't but expect 60% of the American public to say, okay, I guess we shouldn't have been fighting that war. We had no choice but to fight it at the beginning, even the critics kind of acknowledge that. I don't think we had much choice. We couldn't just go in and, try to destroy al-Qaeda and then not care about what came next. And we couldn't be confident al-Qaeda wouldn't come back if we didn't help build something resembling the Afghan army and so forth. And we got 20 years of progress in Afghanistan, achieved at a very slow pace in a very difficult way, obviously, with real price to be paid, both by us and our soldiers and Marines, but also obviously by the Afghan people and monetary price. We got no terrorism from there for 20 years, which is not nothing. And we kept reasonable stability in the immediate region, which again is a very dangerous part of the world. And I really dislike the Pakistanis. They've been playing both sides, the Pakistani governments. They played both sides on this. They helped the Taliban in many ways. I've long been in favor of much tougher policy against Pakistan when we were in Afghanistan. But the fact that Pakistan didn't fall apart, that none of their nuclear and none of their nukes got into the possessions of terrorists, the terrorists didn't take over their government, even though they've infiltrated the armed services probably to some degree, that's not nothing either. So I think it was a crummy situation, but compared to some of the alternatives, a decent situation. And again, I come back to the fact that in 2014, Gandhi didn't quite do it the way I would have wished, but we had handed over the war fighting to the Afghans, and maybe it was deteriorating slowly, and maybe it couldn't have been sustained forever. But I mean, just on the facts, and you really got to come back to that, the situation was tolerable from 2015 through 2020. And I do think, therefore, the burden of proof is very much on the people who say, oh, well, it couldn't have been sustained. Really? Something is sustained for 5 years. It can't be sustained for 7 or 10. I mean, you need to show me why that's fundamentally true. Would we have to go back up to 15,000 troops, which I think is what we had in 2019, maybe before Trump began his last visit? Maybe that's when Trump took over in 2017. I don't think there was a huge raging sentiment here in the U.S. that we couldn't have 15 or 13 or 8,000 troops in Afghanistan for the next few years. So even if we had to go back up from 2,500 a little bit, I think that was doable. So that's, yeah, I think this is an unnecessary humiliation.
We, of course, there are some people who think that we're criticizing Biden too much for all of this, that, you know, it's an unwon war. It was going to be chaotic. Jennifer Rubin, who is also Never Trump, tweeted out about an hour ago, hour from when we're taping here. She refers to, I suppose we would be part of this, the Biden could have left but better crowd. She says that this crowd is self-deluding, because once you decide to leave an unwon war, chaos and suffering ensue, period. No unwon war has ever ended neatly without the enemy's surrender. Really, a lot of the commentary is silly. Look, you know what? I just don't think Never Trump is always Biden. And in this particular case, I think you need to say that even if you support the decision to pull out, and I actually have mixed feelings about that, even if you support that, though, that there is a certain level of expectation that it be done with planning and prudence, and adapt to the changing circumstances and getting things right. And I just don't even know how you make the spin that this was inevitable, or that this is acceptable, or that this is a good look either for America or for Biden. And I think, you know, I think he deserves all the criticism he's getting, to be quite honest.
Look, some of the most powerful criticisms have been from Democratic Congressman Tom Malinowski from New Jersey, Seth Wolten from Massachusetts, Jason Crow from Colorado.
Yep. They've been great.
This is not some kind of like, oh, we have to be critical of Biden because, you know, it shows we're not too Democratic. I wish actually some of the Republican criticism has just been silly and focused on, you know, the sort of the threat of the refugees coming here. Some of the Republican criticism has been responsible and sober and serious. A lot of it has been pure partisanship by Kevin McCarthy and people like that, and not substantive. I wish they were going to the floor and giving much more substantive speeches. But I've got to say, some of the Democrats have been, I think, sober and responsible critics of a Democratic president, which is a good thing. And I don't think we've done much more than echo them. I personally have actually learned from them and have been in touch with them, trying to help get some people out. So I think it's a little odd for, I don't think Never Trumpers, whether we're still Republicans or future former Republicans or ex-Republicans, are required to be more supportive of Joe Biden than a whole lot of Democrats who supported him.
So where do you come down on this? How badly politically damaged is Joe Biden? Reading reports that the White House is counting on them being able to weather this because the war was so unpopular. And so this is going to be, you know, as long as he sticks to his position, that he's going to be okay. I'm skeptical of this. We've watched how nothing seems to move the needle, but this does seem like a out of the ordinary level of political disaster. What's your take?
Yeah, I think it could do real political damage. A huge amount depends on what now happens. I mean, we could, you know, gradually, just being the U.S., we end up getting everyone out, end up getting a fair number of our Afghan friends out, end up, hopefully, that would be wonderful, with no casualties. And people think, it was kind of messed up, he should have organized things better. But at the end of the day, you know, he ended up where he said he was going to end up during the campaign, and he's the president. I'm not going to second guess everything. And you kind of get a reversion to just normal, you know, praise or blame about Biden, support or non-support of Biden on other issues. So that's quite possible, I think. But I do think when you see this kind of operational incompetence, that does, I think, for a lot of voters, signal, oof, boy, I wonder what they should be able to do. I mean, I think we've seen this in the past. Voters give a lot of leeway to presidents on foreign policy. They don't know that much, voters. They know the president has all this information. And, you know, maybe they don't quite agree, or their instinct isn't quite the same. But, you know, he's the president. He's making the tough decisions. I'm not going to necessarily, he's working hard. He seems to have people around him who know what they're doing. I'm not going to second guess it. When you lose confidence in the kind of operational capacity of an administration, I think I've always thought that does the most political damage. For me, that in Iraq, I mean, think about it this way. We didn't find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. It's kind of bad to go to war, premised really on WMDs and not find it. I say this as a supporter of the war, obviously, but Bush won re-election in 2004. People thought, okay, the intelligence agencies really screwed up, but you know what? Saddam was terrible anyway, and maybe it'll work out fine. by mid-late 05, when it was clear that we were not pursuing a winning strategy in Iraq, but we were stubbornly denying that it wasn't winning. And then Katrina happened, and Katrina may be more important of the two, but when Katrina happened, and it just looked like these guys are incompetent. I mean, it's all just a kind of, what's going on? Bush's numbers started to crater in late 05, and they just stayed cratered for the next 3 years. I don't know that we're quite in a Katrina slash Iraq type situation. Same is true of Carter, incidentally. The Iran hostage taking was very bad, and headlines, and did some political damage, just because they were hostages. But I would say the Desert One fiasco with the helicopters may have done more damage, or at least certainly compounded the damage in a very fundamental way. Not only did he somehow have a policy that ended up with these guys being taken hostage, maybe that could have happened with any president, it's who knows, embassies, suddenly they take your embassy hostage. But then you send in the military and they, the helicopters hit each other and try to take off, I guess it was, and 8 Americans die. That, I think, sort of compounded the notion that this guy can't, is not good at being president. And one last point, Sarah made this point to me based on her focus groups. There is that narrative out there about Biden, which I don't believe, but obviously has some penetration beyond maybe just Fox World, that he is a little old. Well, he is a little old. That's part's true. And that he's kind of losing it or isn't quite up to the job and stumbles and so forth. And in that respect, the failures of management fit into a bit to a narrative of maybe he's not quite up to the job anyway. And did you notice that he stumbled over this in his speech or at his press conference? And, a lot of that stuff, it's hard to put your finger on, but, over months and even a year or two, it can add up to a sense of among swing voters and voters who aren't following some of the policy disputes that much, a little bit of a sense of, oof, maybe this president's not quite up to it. So I think it could be pretty damaging to Joe Biden.
Taking Joe Biden out of the picture just for a moment, I'm going to come back to him. There's this also larger loss of faith in institutions and in elites, and I don't think this is going to help. Because I think the people look around and go, how could they gotten this so wrong? How could the military have gotten this so wrong? How could our intelligence agencies have gotten this so wrong again? And whether or not these same people are looking at, say, the CDC and beginning to doubt or question the credibility of those agencies. So what happens when people begin to doubt the basic competence and reliability of government institutions? I mean, that can be a very, very subversive thing in and of itself. And we know where that leads, where, say, hey, let's have a failed game show host as president because he's going to burn it all down, right? I mean, we actually like that. But going back to Biden, I think this hits him on two things. And I agree that if the public thinks that he lacks the capacity to be president, that's kind of a fundamental problem. But this failure seems to go to two of his main branding positives: competence and empathy. We actually thought that he was going to be the competent grown-up, right? Because he had all of this experience. And we also thought of him, I certainly thought of him, as deeply empathetic and very sort of, would deal with things on a human level. And I don't think that came through. That empathy, there was a moment today during his speech where I think he was empathetic. But I was really struck by it did feel kind of a certain callousness, which apparently is not new in his background. And Peter Weiner had a devastating piece in The Atlantic where he talked about, all of, Biden's comments over the years suggesting we don't have a moral authority to our, Afghan allies. We don't have a moral obligation to women in Afghanistan. And I have to say that kind of rattled my sense of knowing or understanding who Joe Biden was.
Yeah, that's interesting. On your first point, I think you're talking to Eric Edelman. I think he's on this podcast next week on Tuesday.
Next week.
Tell me.
Mm-hmm.
So I was chatting with him this morning. He made exactly the point you made about the overall question of our institutions. You look at the somewhat chaotic return to school for kids, this week, next week, and so forth. And I don't think it's the CDC's fault exactly, but the combination of local, state governments, federal government, the system does not seem to be working as seamlessly and flawlessly as it should. And then you look at what's happening over there in Kabul and you think, ooh, not the U.S. government does not seem to be, U.S. elites do not seem to be functioning well. U.S. public maybe isn't too responsible either. Look at the vaccines and it can, mm-hmm. it can lead people to be down on the country, which is fine if it leads to reform and to demands for better performance, but can be taken in very irresponsible directions, obviously. And so,
yeah, I mean, if
I think that's a good point.
Yeah, people feel that liberal democracy just doesn't work anymore. There are all kinds of bad consequences for that. So I don't know. Were you ever a fan of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
No,
never. Okay,
I remember it.
It's one of my favorite books of all time, including the characters, the people known as the Vogons, who are the bureaucrats, and the Vogons are the dumbest, most callous, slowest possible bureaucrats in the entire universe who just don't give a shit about anything. And it did occur to me that I wonder if we're sort of having a moment, or are the Vogons running the United States? I mean, between the sluggish State Department that keeps moving slower than the slowest DMV anywhere in approving these visas, to the FDA, which even at this point can't formally approve the vaccines. I mean, how many tens of millions of samples do they need to make up their mind about whether they're going to approve that? We really are seeing how much these really slow, sluggish, often indifferent bureaucracies are shaping and distorting these issues. And I've never been a fan of bureaucracies, but that's at least one of the subtexts of all of this, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. That's interesting. And I mean, I don't know. It seems like maybe they couldn't just get enough data to be able to say before the beginning of the school year that, 5 to 12-year-olds could and should be vaccinated. But I mean, we would be in a lot better shape, for example, if that could have been done 2 weeks earlier. Maybe it was impossible, but or maybe more than 2 weeks earlier. Maybe they won't get it done until October. But so an awful lot of things, going badly at once. And this is a little reminiscent also of 2005 when you got Iraq and Katrina and Harriet Myers and just a general sense right. of incompetence and chaos. I don't think we're quite there. I mean, thank God. And I think, we still have, Biden's done a pretty good job on COVID generally. And thank God we are vaccinated and the deaths aren't nearly what they would be. And can't really blame him for the Delta variant. The other one I would make, just again, it's not as if, okay, whatever happens in Afghanistan happens and then it sort of ends and then there's second guessing. But, it will continue to have consequences. There won't be any news from the store from Afghanistan itself over the next 3 years. And more importantly, it's not as if it won't have ramifications in the area in Pakistan and elsewhere. And I come back to the pieces we had earlier this week at the Bulwark that I thought were really excellent by Charles Fairbanks and Robert Jasinski. On sort of, what a shot in the arm this gives the jihadists. And you see Haqqani being, prancing around Kabul as kind of the de facto mayor of Kabul. And suddenly everything that we paid a price for in the past, when they seem to have the upper hand, when they seem to be the strong horse, we now are going to pay, I'm worried that we will pay a price for again. And again, that's another thing Biden just gave away willfully. We had, Trump to his credit, Obama to his credit, and then Trump did crush ISIL, whatever you want to call it, the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq between about 2014 when we got back in and 2017. Now, in the course, first there was this huge, after we got out of Iraq, of course, this huge rise of the terrorists, which had huge implications in Europe and elsewhere, and a revival of terrorism and a revival of jihadism. We finally got that turned around after about 2015. And by 2018, 19, my sense around the world, I'm not saying there were no people getting recruited to be jihadists, but my sense is that they were kind of on their back foot and they were felt like they were in retreat. And there was, you could see things happening in the Middle East, for example, that were somewhat hopeful, and it just felt different. And I do worry a lot now that reverses again and we get back to a 2014, 2015 situation. And that would really be terrible for all kinds of reasons, obviously. So anyway, I think the notion that this is just sort of a one and done kind of event that's not the way the world works, you know. And do our allies have confidence in us? And do other authoritarians get emboldened? And do jihadists take a run at another government somewhere? And, you know, all kinds of things could happen.
Well, and also go back to your point about how, you know, the mood of the country, you know, can be affected by things that are really sort of not related. People connect the dots. I mean, you know, masks in schools are really not the same story, but they all come together. If you think about where we were back in May and June, the incredible optimism, the economy is coming back. We had beaten COVID. The administration seemed to have the wind at its back, and Joe Biden really became kind of the symbol of kind of an American healing and renewal and coming back. That's gone now. The question is whether you can get it back, whether or not, because we've seen things change very, very quickly. So if, in fact, the Delta variant does fade away, if we do get on the other side, if the economy remains strong, if this recedes from the public consciousness, can you reverse this? Yes. But I think there's also that when someone has really fundamentally disappointed you, it's hard to get back. I think it's hard to get that love and feeling back again. If you know what I mean? So we're in for a long slog. I'm going to make a prediction right now, based on just the tenor of the criticism of this, and which is that if the Republicans win control of the House next year, which I think is more likely than not. I think the chances are way above 50-50 that they will find some pretext to impeach Joe Biden.
Yeah.
If for no other reason than to cheapen the impeachment process, to take away the sting of the double impeachment of Donald Trump, but also because this is now the new normal, that the base will require that every time you disagree or somebody has a misstep, you demand that they resign, that they be impeached, or it's a sign that we should invoke the 25th Amendment. I mean, maybe that's just a sign of the new normal hysteria of our politics, but no one should be surprised if there is a Biden impeachment under a Kevin McCarthy-led House of Representatives. And I'm not saying I'm rooting for that in any way whatsoever.
And now, happy weekend from Charlie.
Yes, yes. And well, that's kind of, yeah, but there was no way we were going to go into the weekend with happy talk. Look, I hope that he is getting the sense that Biden needed a change of the tone, that he needed to make a stronger commitment to get Americans out, to get others out. I do think he's misreading public opinion. I wish he was more definitive about staying past that August 31st deadline. But if, in fact, we do make some progress, if the Taliban decides that it's in their interest to get us the hell out, and I guess that's what they're counting on, right? Mm-hmm. Is that the Taliban are saying, look, let's be on reasonable good behavior, which is like a very, very low bar for them. What does that mean? Like, you know, just beating people with chains as opposed to beheading them in the streets? That's an upgrade for the Taliban. At least they want us out, and so therefore they're not going to do anything particularly horrific. But boy, anytime you're reliant on the goodwill of the Taliban for any good things to happen, you're in a terrible place. And I think that's the way we're going into the weekend, Mr. Crystal.
Yeah, but I think it captures the truth, and there's no point having happy talk at this point, honestly. And I do hope that Biden himself, I hope members of Congress, members of his own administration, are truthful and are truthful to him. I mean, he's very stubborn, maybe we'll just kind of, even at the margin, though, I think people in the State Department, Defense could be doing things that Biden doesn't quite know about that could help the situation. And members of Congress really should think seriously when they get back what they can do, you know, make it clearer to Joe Biden that there's support for doing more, so we have a better outcome. Because it really is important, not just for Biden, sure, but really for the country and for the world. It's still, this is going to be bad either way, in my view, and sort of a black mark for the U.S. and will have negative consequences. Big difference between a foreign policy mistake and a foreign policy, a mismanaged foreign policy that has moderately bad consequences that peter out after a while and that could be reversed in some cases, maybe not in the country itself, but elsewhere. Big difference between that and a foreign policy mistake that is just allowed to sort of go unchecked and metastasize and really could become the first of a series of things that starts to snowball. And I think that's really what serious national security people within the administration, outside, commenting on it, need to think hard about, because that they're very bad scenarios that could happen over the next few years, or there are moderately bad ones, or there are, we could come to grips with this and recover from this. But those are pretty different outcomes ultimately.
Well, and to your point though, I think one of the good developments, one of the good pieces of news is the fact that there are these strong voices within the Democratic Party, within Joe Biden's own party, telling him that he's got to do the right thing. I mean, people like Seth Moulton are not pulling any punches. They're being very, very direct. And so unlike the sort of reflexive Republican support for Donald Trump, you're not seeing that kind of tribal reaction. And you are right. My sense is that there's an overwhelming majority of Democrats, elected Democrats, who, if they had the chance, would tell Joe Biden, you have to do better, you have to get this right. And I think that's a positive development because, even though, we may deplore this particular development, that there's a lot at stake in the success of the Biden presidency at this point. And that means that you have to have more of his friends telling him these hard truths. So again, I hope people understand that. I think in some ways we're trying to do that too. Bill Kristol, thank you so much for hanging around late on a Friday afternoon to do this podcast.
It was my pleasure. It was a sobering and not a very pleasurable, I guess, discussion in that respect, in the sense of cheering everyone up. But it was my pleasure to join you, obviously.
And thank you all for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again. And one quick note, I usually put out a newsletter over the weekend with reader feedback, and we have a ton of Bulwark reader feedback on Afghanistan. I hope I can get a lot of it into the Sunday newsletter. But the warning is I might have to break it into two separate newsletters because we have the full range of opinions. And as usual, Bulwark listeners and readers are thoughtful and often eloquent, but also have very, very pointed positions. And they don't all agree with us. But hey, we never promised you a safe space. Have a great weekend.